This recording is a production of the Conservative Anabaptist Education Committee. This presentation was recorded at Conservative Anabaptist School Board Institute 2020, held in Belleville, Pennsylvania on March 6 and 7.
Thank you for coming again today. I am glad you're enjoying your time. And I guess the clock says it's time to get started. And I think there's just so many things on our hearts. Why don't we just pause for prayer? Our Father in heaven, thank you for loving us. And again, we want to give you our hearts today. As we've been thinking about the troublesome things of this world and all the problems of our generation and the things that could steal the hearts of our children, our response, we just want to give you our hearts and love you and ask you to lead us and guide us in our day as we relate to a rising generation and generations to come, because we know that it's your work, not ours. And just show us where we can fit in to serve you faithfully today. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you for coming again today as we look at preschool foundations. I just say a few things in opening. One is I did bring some of my paddles along. And they're over there, and if you want one, take it along. I don't know if I'll have enough for everybody, but I should. And, I don't know. If I don't, you can contact me later, because we do make them all the time. I also felt like I didn't have the material that I needed in the handout, and so last night when I went home, and I have a new handout today with little questions, you can get some of the answers from what is written in the book, but we're going somewhere else. And maybe you could just see if anybody else needs one. If you didn't get one when you walked in, certainly raise your hand and make it known. I really appreciated the Nehemiah. Yeah, it's just questions is what it is. The lesson from Nehemiah today, and I really appreciated that every family built their own section of the wall. But guess what? They had to make sure that it connected with the rest of the people's work. If they didn't make those connections, what would they have had? What would they have had if they just built the section where they lived and that was it? And it didn't match up with anyone else's. And today, that's primarily what we're going to be thinking about. And with that discussion about technology, my heart is really, really burdened. Because when he talked about the last thing you touch at night and the first thing you touch in the morning and what you can't live without for 5 minutes, I'm guilty. You know? I hope it doesn't have my heart, but it sure has my attention. I am glad that sometimes I have to drive the road and they just don't want you touching it while you're driving. That's a really good thing. But I want my heart to be with my Father. And I will admit that technology has a way of bringing other temptations into your life. And that's going to tie into our questions here today. Because I really don't think that we can leave anything for the next generation unless we have it ourselves. That's where it has to start. I did want to just mention a few more things. We had a session in our family. It was a group from, in our area, a group from Ohio came, maybe more of the remnant type group. There was a Mark Miller who talked about what he did in his family. And I just want to mention this by way of an idea, and they would take a different child. They had half as many as we did, and I wasn't sure how that would have worked for us, but they'd take a different child and kind of like have a date night. No, it's not a date with your own child, but as a child got old enough to enjoy playing a game together with that one, and then the next week or the next day, whatever it was, that night would be a child night, and then you could talk about their social life, their development, even moral issues is a time to do that. I cannot say we did that. It never even dawned on me to do something like that, but looking back, I wish we would have had kept more of our connections with our children. I know I've talked about treasuring our children, and I, you know, the more I look at that as I go through life, I just feel so important that, because they'll figure out what you're. Here we are again. What's this? What did I do the other day? Whenever I got this to work again. Maybe you could just like go over the T's again. Does anybody remember what they are? The first one was treasure. And that, you never grow out of that time. You treasure them. But then you come down to the very first, their toddler stage. What's that?
Train.
Confront their will. Get them to learn to hearken. They need to listen up. They need to pay attention when you say something. You need to mean what you say, and you need to be consistent, and you have to follow through with, yes, the rod, because that's what makes them feel there has to be some pain, some corporal pain go along with it. And as a parent, you can understand what's appropriate as they develop. And then after training is
teaching,
because they come question box, full of questions, some more than others, but they question. And it's a time for you to give intelligent answers. And I'll treasure this. The young man did not know it, but I was following him down the road. And as we came to the red light there at Myerstown, he was in the pickup truck in front of me, and his little girl's head was bobbing beside him. And this is 30 years ago. But I could just see he was talking to her, and they were going back and forth. And within a week, he died of a heart attack. And I just thought about that opportunity, the bonding that was going on between them. And he didn't know that was going to happen, but that's my last memory of him, and I appreciate that. After teach and comes transition. You begin to share your child with a larger world, and it's scary, but every stage is difficult. It's scary because they form other friendships. They go off to school. Other people speak into their life, and we're actually going to be talking about that more today with our questions. And then after transition is trust. It's so hard, but every child needs to feel dad's hand on his shoulder, or in our case, father, hand on his shoulder saying, you know, son, I'm going to trust you with this. And there's so much yelling and putting down, and you didn't do that right, and so many children who are hurt, recoiling from dad's, mom's reactions to them, and there's no way to have that relationship where you're best friends for a lifetime, if it's going to be that kind of a platform in their teenage years, because your teenage, fortunately, children come to us maybe a little under 10 pounds, and they don't know anything. And for those first few years, do any of you remember having your diaper changed, or that stuff that happens whenever you're throwing up because you're sucking on a bottle or whatever it is? No, God makes that. It's just, what if we came 200, they came 200 pounds with a fully developed memory, you know? But God does this in the right kind of way. But as they transition through, you come to a place where you have to turn loose. And that's our next one. Turning over your resources. What are your goals for life? What do you feel pulled into? I remember some of those discussions with our children, and some of them had really weird dreams. They wanted to be graphic designers, and that never, ever occurred to me that you'd do that for a lifetime. Or there was others that wanted to work with computers in different ways, you know? And your children get gifts from so many different places, but God has a calling for them. And when they feel like you're an ally in that stage of life to develop into whatever God is calling them for. Because really, they're just given to you for a moment. We can just leave the last one off, right? What was the last one we talk about? I gave this talk in a community, and I didn't even realize how much it fit. But trading roles is so important, because there was an old man, and I don't know if his family tried to get him to stop driving or not. But he drove into the sunset, and he never saw the young couple with five children that was there, and he ran over them and killed them. And why couldn't he have listened and not been driving anymore? Well, there are people who are determined that they are never going to give up. But you know what? That old pattern is started whenever the children are little. Either you're going to get on one highway and end up with wonderful family relationships when you're done, or you're going to get on the other highway, and it's going to be chaos. And I've seen so many of those. Now, let's go to the questions, or we'll never get over them today. Oh, I was going to do a little more review. I can't get this to work, but it's probably not its fault. It's probably mine. Why don't you want to play with something? Any of you have any ideas about how to get that to go to the next place? It may not be that. It may be. What were the elements of the new covenant? And I'm sorry. I guess I'm supposed to stand still. What were the elements of the new covenant that turned fathers' hearts to children and children to their fathers? Now, I almost started talking about this a while ago. I want you to tell me. What were the? It might be the connections in here, because it just sits too long. And does that do it?
Yeah, you can use your arrow keys.
Okay.
It's probably a Bluetooth connection.
Okay, I was going to review those P's, but I won't anymore. I will go to. Wait a minute. This is way back. 10 of 45. All right. Let's just go over our questions. I was just going to put the questions up there anyway. Maybe I'll just go back to this one because it's a good thing to leave on the board. But what were the elements of the new covenant? Malachi said, when Elijah comes and the platform John the Baptist laid down and Jesus picked up and the apostles, naturally turns children's hearts to their parents and parents, and what are the essential elements? If you don't remember anything else, I want you to remember this.
Transparency.
What are some more words that fit in with that? John the Baptist called them to do what?
Repent.
And what do you do when you repent?
Say I'm sorry.
Say I'm sorry. You acknowledge who you are. You are real with who you are with the people who are around you. You got it working? Okay, don't worry about it.
Like you said, Bluetooth, you have to do from the computer.
Oh. Duh. That's what happens to us sometimes. We don't make the connection. You got to pull this thing out and plug it in. Okay. That's our problem. We don't get that one little connection done, and so it's not going to work. All right. Well, I didn't want to start it. I'm going to let it go anyway. Be honest with who you are. Be real. Be transparent. What did they have to do with their sins? They had to confess their sins. Did they have to have another sacrifice for their sins? Doesn't say they asked for that when John the Baptist came. But after they had stepped forward, and John 3 explains why the Pharisees didn't come. Why? Because they didn't want to come to the light, lest their deeds should be reproved. They didn't want to acknowledge who they were. And I can connect with that. I was a little Pharisee boy. I grew up in a community where we were the only Mennonite family, and we had to be extra good, and we couldn't act like, we prayed for everybody because everybody else was lost, but we couldn't act like, well, somehow you had to just show that you were different than everybody else. Anybody else like that here? And so you could be dirty and rotten on the inside, but you couldn't act, you couldn't show that. You had to be a model for what your family was trying to be in the community. And then to be honest with what was going on, to be transparent. It requires a lot of humility. You cannot be a mom or a dad in your home relationships if you're not for real. Whenever I was in Alberta, Lester Bauman gave me the book. And it's not a true book, but it's true, okay? Sylvester's Journal. You'll see it published by CAM. I think every man ought to read that. Every man ought to read. Any of you read it yet, Sylvester? A few hands going up. I just cried and cried and cried when I read that. And it's a terrible thing to acknowledge, but it's so easy to have secrets. And that's a story of somebody who died with secrets. And some people say, it's not a true story. How would you ever write a true story like that? How would you write a true story that ends up so horrible and then, that really was my grandfather. I can't help but tell you that I'm a little proud to tell somebody my grandfather was Taxi Davy Stossfus and the smiles that come on their faces. But I also know that some of us have people in our ancestry that we're embarrassed to acknowledge. So how do you write a book? But the book is good because it really makes you think deeply of the phony life and what happens if you live with secrets in your life. So let's go on. The next question that we have. Oh, what else? There was two more elements that I talked about. I wondered if you got. Anybody have those? What did John the Baptist do for every person who wanted to become a part of the kingdom of heaven? Pardon? Baptism. So that is, it's baptism. What is baptism? He was a Levite. He ceremonially washed vessels, preparation for the tabernacle, temple, whatever stage you're in. But this time he's doing it to people. Pharisees could join from any tribe and be a part of the synagogue. That was a big step from only the Levites could be in the program. In the synagogue, anybody could be in it. But all of a sudden, regardless of your background, and if you knew all the rules, and if you were performance-oriented or not, you could come to John the Baptist, confess your sins, and he would give you a ceremonial washing that made you a part of the kingdom of heaven. Why did Jesus want baptism? Because he is the anointed one. He had to be anointed to start his earthly ministry. He could not start it without a high priest or a Levite, a high priest doing that for him. Everybody had to have that if they wanted to have if they had an earthly ministry. Sidetrack there. You got that one free. What else did they have to do?
Behold the Lamb.
Yes. Behold the Lamb of God. And that is a lifestyle. And I want to make sure you carry that away with you, because if we try to go out of here without that, we're not going to be able to get through the rest. Number two, what should be our conclusion when ongoing tensions exist between members in a family? Siblings, moms and dads. Nobody have an answer for that? You can't help.
According to the scripture, there's pride somewhere.
There's pride somewhere. This question bothered me on the way home last night, and I made a phone call. It's a situation of tension in our family. Did you know about my failures? Has that impacted your life? Can you talk about the real issues? How are you going to raise children when you haven't worked things out with your own siblings, with your own parents? You say, well, our family is so dysfunctional. Don't talk, don't trust, don't feel. You can't fix your parents. But you can do what you can do to repair relationships. And that's what it takes in order to raise toddlers even. You can do everything right, but if they don't sense it's right, they're going to be picking up things all along. Pride. Something is wrong at the foundation in the core. Number three, now we get into classroom. What are some reasonable expectations of parents about their child's classroom? What do you expect to happen when you send a child off to school? Do you get anything from what we've been talking about, the ideal structure of a home, of a classroom? Okay. High in love and high in discipline, which is authoritative. I always get it mixed up with authoritarian. Authoritarian is a big stick, and I have a little stick here, so you know I believe in that. But when they go into the classroom, why? What's the purpose of a classroom? Every child should have the right to have an environment that is conducive to learning. They need to learn. They need to be able to increase in their expansion into knowledge. They need to know the principles for learning, have that subconsciously. And as they're in that environment, they need to be able to accumulate, acquire knowledge. Now, what has to happen in a classroom? Let's get practical now. Let's break that down.
Order.
They know what to expect. If a teacher is not authoritative, there will be chaos. I don't know if you had any of those or not, and I'm sorry. Once upon a time that I was a principal in a situation where there was a classroom that totally disintegrated. I did too know what was going on. I didn't know that I would have some of my former students in this class. So I can't really talk about that situation, because the rule in that situation is you don't talk. And it was never talked out. We never admitted that there was a teacher who was scared of their students and didn't keep order, and the children tore the room apart. We're going to have a question here a little later. What should you do when you know that's happening? Okay, but order. What else?
There ought to be love.
There ought to be love. There ought to be respect between children. Do you know how children will pick out? Was there somebody picked on in your schoolroom? Was there someone that everybody picked on? I can talk about Myrtle Potter, I think. Nobody would know her. Or Mavis. I started to say the typing program. I always think of that. What's that, Mavis Beacon? This one was Mavis Betterman. Everybody picked on Myrtle. The family was a needy family. It was a poor family. And if you wanted to insult somebody, we as children, is that okay? If children, no. And so the parent, the teacher, you expect them to be involved and pick up on those signals and deal with that. So respect should be a part of it. What should a parent do when they sense their child's teacher is not serving as a teacher? Maybe they're just a babysitter. I remember one of my siblings coming home from school, and we had a Christian school by then, and I was older. And when she came home from school, about the third day of the school year, she said, "I can tell we're not going to learn anything this year." What should you do? I was just an older sibling. I had no responsibility, but I never forgot it. And I watched that teacher's life, and that's the way it was. Okay, don't believe everything your child says. Thank you very much. We have a generation coming on where with fewer children in families, and I know I've picked on that enough, with fewer children, and my child is right, and I'm going to stick up for my child, it's older teachers, people serving in classrooms tell me this problem is growing. In fact, I got a long lecture last night. I told one of the men at church that I didn't know what I was going to do today. And he said, "Well, straighten out the ladies, because the mamas are sticking up for their children way too much." So I said, that's where I would start. Okay, don't believe everything that Junior says. But what? Open your ears and open your eyes and pay attention. How will you know when fundamentals of teaching is not happening in that classroom? How will you know that?
Grades.
Pardon?
Grades.
Grades. What kind of grades?
Bad ones.
Bad ones? Okay.
Not
yeah. What else will you sense?
Attitudes.
Attitudes will go down about school. Before I taught school, I picked up a book from Clay Bookstore, and it was called Classroom Management. And I think it's still somewhere on my shelf. But as I read that, it was just written by about the early 1900s by a man who was superintendent of schools. And he would go into two-room schoolhouses. And as he went into those schoolhouses, he said, on one side of the hall would be children who would be obviously bored, lazy, scuffing their feet, leaning back in their chair, whispering, maybe even throwing spitballs, that kind of thing. And then you'd step across the hall, and the children would be
all engaged in what the teacher was teaching. They'd be leaning forward in their seats and waving their hands. And then I remembered some of the classes that I had student taught in and paid attention to. I admired the classrooms where the teacher was kept the children engaged and they were involved. And I thought you could probably almost tell within about 5 minutes of visiting that classroom if there was that kind of involvement or not, or whether the children were disengaged and really were bored in their situation. But that's not the question. What should a parent do? Keith.
Talk to the principal.
Talk to the teacher. First. Matthew 18.
And it's also helpful to remember that this teacher was hired by the school board.
So talk to the school board.
Well, you know, I'm saying, okay, so you're putting in, sometimes we put in someone who's never had any children, and they're supposed to teach children? And then we wonder why they can't? So if you go to the school board right away and then they have to get involved, well, that demoralizes the teacher. If you can come to the teacher and give them some, let them know you're behind them. And you know what? You're allowed to be a little harder on the children.
Mm-hmm.
We'll stand behind you if you're
mm-hmm.
harder on them.
Mm-hmm.
That might get further than going to the school board right away and saying, like happened to me, I was principal, and 3 days after school started, parents said that one of these teachers isn't fit to teach.
So then what? Question number 8. Why should a mother be first to believe? Why would a mother be first to believe her child is treated unfairly, and what should she do about it? Let's shift this. It's connected, but let's get both of them while we're here. Why would a mother be the first to believe it?
Well, that's what moms do.
Okay. She is emotionally involved with her children. She's raised them, weaned them, brought them up, and they're gone off to school, and she hears the chatter when they come home. There are casual comments and what they have to say, and she's listening. She's paying attention. And so she's the first to hear it or believe it, or she senses a problem, and what should she do about it? Talk to Dad. And what does Dad do? Well, like so many other things that Mom says, he just forgets about it.
Unless he's the principal.
Unless he's the principal.
He should listen.
He should listen. He should care. And I like the idea that was given here. Okay, the board hires, the principal is there. It depends a little bit on the size of the school. But I, looking back, I cannot believe, my wife and I were both teachers, but I cannot believe the stories that our children have about their teachers. Some of the ones who were so extremely abusive. We had a teacher that we had that the children still today struggle to forgive and let it go the way she treated them. We also have the horror stories of teachers who absolutely just babysat. They didn't cover their material. How come we didn't see that? Why did we sense that was going on? As adults, they tell us those things. And I trust their judgment today. But what, you know, how did that happen before our eyes? And I really think that as parents, we got way too involved in, I got too involved in trying to make a living for a family. And my wife was involved with trying to raise the children. And of course, we connected and we had our own problems and issues, but I wish that we could go back and visit school a little more and listen and pay attention. But also, I like the idea of that personal communication. How do you feel about school and how do you feel it's going? And my child makes this observation. Is that fair or what do you think about this? Some of that sharing first of all. I know I tend to draw from another level of relationships. But in our congregations, in our ministerial teams, when somebody is ordained, we have an orientation. And we have the commitment. We have a paper that we read. It doesn't have to be that.
But we say to each other, it is my goal to help you to be the very best deacon that you can be, or the very best preacher or bishop. My goal to help you. God has called you to this. Now, to this, what would happen if you would go to the teachers, and it's, I respect that you are called to this position. I believe that you have been called to this. May I talk with you? May I communicate with you if issues come up along the way? Now, schools vary so much from a little tiny little one-room school to a great big 10 rooms, 150, 200 students, or maybe even more than that. And so to connect with each one, maybe it's not fair in every situation. My daughter was talking about the little orientation they had whenever all the parents brought their children to school, showed them their desk, and they had a personal chat with how they wanted their relationship to be. And she looked back at that as being a very positive thing, as they actually talked about how can we pull together to help our children in this situation. I don't know, I'm sure that I don't have the answers, but one thing for sure, keep your ears open, talk to your husbands, wives, men. If your wife's talking to you about it, take it seriously, and maybe go and ask a question and open the door and try to get the feel of it. Because sometimes, believe it or not, there are atrocious or horrible or sinful things, wrong things happen in our schoolrooms that we are responsible for if we just did not pay any attention to it. Anybody else have anything you want to say on that?
When there are parent-teacher meetings, when there are parent-teacher conferences, be ready to discuss those things.
All right, when there are parent-teacher conferences, be ready to talk about those things. So before you go off to that special meeting with the teacher, you find your child and say, what's a good thing to ask your child? Or did you talk to your child beforehand?
We sometimes did, but we like to know how school's going.
How do you feel about school? Anything you have to say? We like to hear it. I don't know. I didn't do that. But we did go to the conferences, and I enjoyed talking to the teachers and hearing them out.
You need to be careful with that, then. The children don't think you're going to go straighten out the teacher.
Exactly. And yet, there are, today yet, we have children that come and say, why in the world did you not get a hold of that teacher that we had? You know, and I don't know. Okay, question number 5. What are some reasonable questions? Let's see, how long do we go? 10 more minutes? Okay, we'll try to... What are some reasonable expectations of teachers toward the children coming to their class? Moms, why don't you answer this? Why don't you teachers answer that? Any teachers here? People who were teachers? What are reasonable expectations? Okay.
That they had a good night of rest and breakfast and a good attitude.
Very good. A good night of rest, a good breakfast, and a good attitude. And you should be able to make sure that happens. Anything else that you'd like to say?
Well-groomed. Clean.
Clean? Well-groomed? Yes.
Homework done?
Prompt obedience.
Pardon?
Prompt obedience. That's the one I was actually listening for. That's a character issue, but I like the personal issues too. What happens, this doesn't happen so much for us anymore, but sometimes in church you'll see that, you can tell that somebody's been in the barn just before they came to church. Is it okay to let your children go to school that way? What do you think? Pardon? Nothing to do about it? Not okay? The problem is that this children pick that up with each other and, you know, it can be a problem. Number 6, what will be the outcome when a child feels his parents take his side against the teacher?
Disaster.
Rebellion.
Same if one parent would take the side of a child, it just will not work.
He will tell other students.
Do you? Yeah. Okay.
I think this ties together with the question 4. It's in the same vein.
And I have always been amazed when we have these kind of situations where the teacher was either obviously in the wrong or a huge misunderstanding or something. In every case, I could think of that this was a fractal or a small situation that is they're going to experience later on in life, in leadership, in business, in church. I always found a tremendous opportunity at that point to unpack this for them and help them understand that life is like this. When you're in business someday, or you're married, you have your own family, you're going to experience the network effect of so many things, and put that in that light in the future. And now, this is how you relate to it. And sometimes I could even take their side in a certain way. In other words, this was wrong. There were times when some things in school that were very, very obviously wrong. And it would be inauthentic or disingenuous to not admit to it. But it wasn't an issue of taking sides. Respecting authority could be fully enforced and fully appreciated while also understanding, well, this is a little lesson for you in a very appropriate time for something that's going to come later in life, prepared for it.
Thank you very much. Because it's easy just to brush the child off. You're too busy to listen. What do you do then? That says take their side. But you hear the story and you're like, get over it. You haven't helped them to learn the bigger lesson of life. And there's really nothing more sad than the story of Saul, who's pitying himself with all that poisonous that he's been drinking and thinking about David and the rebellion against him. You know, and this is some old people. They come to the end of life, and I forget the title of the sermon that I had been assigned to one winter Bible school, but it's I Have Been Wronged. That was the title. And there's some people carry that attitude everywhere. And it's a very good time to do exactly what was brought up here, is help your child to realize you will be wronged in life. Authorities make mistakes. What can you learn from this? How can you overcome it? Did you make an appeal? Did you ask the teacher anything about it? Maybe it's just best to forbear and forgive, because that is part of life. That's a lot of life. Any other comments on this? Okay.
I might add that if the focus is finding truth and the right thing to do and move forward versus who's wrong, it's a total different attitude and mindset, and the outcome will be different. If we pursue truth and the right path forward and let whoever's wrong be wrong, it's a more redemptive way of moving forward.
But what if you think you're pretty sure that when you explore it all, the teacher's going to be wrong?
We're still in America where we're innocent until proven guilty, right?
Sometimes. Okay?
The teacher will be wrong sometimes.
Then what?
That's what? I think talking to the teacher. First of all, I mean, if we actually are a team together, then talking to them and saying, hey, did you realize? They might not even know.
Exactly. Exactly.
If they would only know, well, then this can easily be taken care of. Now, when there are abusive situations, we can't teach.
That's right.
We don't need that.
We don't need that. Yes. And there was a hand back here.
I like the discussion in the context of if you have to face a problem that the teacher is wrong, and the idea of admitting it to your child in a very serious discussion is way better than not resolving it and having snide remarks about the teacher 2 weeks later. In other words, that's going to breed just more disrespect, whereas a serious discussion, admitting the wrongs, and working through it properly is actually going to deserve some respect.
Thank you very much. These are very, very good answers, because, I don't know. That's just so much my tendency to brush it off and then drop those caustic, snide remarks, you know. And it's just better to face it and do what you can do, but sometimes you have to let it rest, because it will ripen if it really is a situation that needs more attention than what you alone can do. Any other thoughts on that one?
I know I already talked a lot, but I taught school in our community several years, and I'm also analytical personality, and I noticed that there's this one family that the children just all do exceptionally well. So I set out to see what the variable was.
Okay.
And I determined that the variable...
Can you all hear him okay? Okay.
The variable was that the parents of these children had a very unique way of keeping the teachers highly accountable. They would regularly ask the teacher, how are my children doing, and what can we do to contribute? And I think that did several things.
That makes the teacher accountable?
Makes the teacher accountable, because he knows that the parent's going to follow up. I'm going to give account, because when I have to explain how their child is doing, if he's not doing well, I'm also going to have to explain why he's not doing well. And the children also know that mom and dad are asking the teacher. It just keeps the whole thing balanced, everybody accountable. And the road paved for communication when there is a problem.
Exactly. Thank you very much for that. It makes me think of when adult to adult talk together, we do think a little different than when a child is assessing a situation. Didn't Paul say, when I was a child, I thought as a child, I understood as a child, I spake as a child, when I became a man? I know that's transitioning from the Old Testament, from the miracles and signs times to where we are today, having the written word, but there's still a lesson there. And when you talk to the teachers and ask them for reports and they're evaluating it, I like that. It holds them accountable. It really does. Any other thoughts in relation to this question?
I've heard said that Sunday dinner, the family would have preachers for dinner, meaning they would discuss and criticize what was talked about.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that mom and dad, or the dad particularly, I think the same thing can happen for our teachers. If we talk about that, about our teachers, maybe they have down or they have faults. Nobody's perfect. But if we talk about that in front of the children will pick up on it.
It's just so important that the way we view the other authorities that we're equal with or that are in our lives. I mean, okay, I serve as a bishop in our church, but that deacon, that trustee, the teacher in the school, they have responsibilities that I must respect that are in their sphere. They're over me. They're over my children. Do you see what I'm saying? Because they're assigned by the church to do that. I cannot just act like, well, I can boss everybody around. It was a bishop who told me he nailed the nursery door shut. And I said, you're going to lose your church. And he did. Why? Can't bishops nail nursery doors shut?
No.
Thank you. I agree. That's somebody else's job. They were using it for a walkway, and he didn't think they should. Did we do number 7? What are some ways parents can prepare a parent? I'm sorry, this is a grammatical mistake. What are some ways parents can prepare their children to accept the authority of a teacher?
Have structure at home.
Structure at home.
You mentioned we can't give what we don't have. If we don't respect our authorities, we're not going to give that.
Exactly. Show visible signs of respect for other authorities. Well, I guess our time is up. So I better stop because the schedule is over me. I answer to that authority. Any comments in closing yet?
Shall I nail the door shut?
You're excused. The talk can continue, but you're excused.
Okay, maybe you should take that up with us.
Yeah. I have enjoyed this a lot more than I thought I would, but thank you so much for contributing today, and thank you for computer for not even working. I didn't have anything more than the questions.
So where do we get the rest of the answers?
I was having fun when my son-in-law would read, and they gave me, the ladies worked on it first, and I got some of the questions at church. But when my son-in-law would say, now that's a good question, I like that. It made me feel like, well, it's ready to go. You're excused.
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. Order online at www.christianlearning.org or call 877-222-4769.